7 weeks from taking office, future Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney is not wasting any time setting up shop. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Philadelphia Mayor-elect Jim Kenney has named more key members of his cabinet, including his chief education officer, as WHYY's Katie Culinary reports.
For that job, Kenney has chosen South Philadelphia High School principal Otis Hackney, who's credited with dramatically improving the culture of a school once racked by racial violence. Hackney says he thinks Kenney's goal of getting his universal pre-K plan off the ground by September is realistic. He's also anxious to start working on creating community schools.
Everyone thinks that it's just having a doctor's office or a vision center in a school. Those are some things to have, but it's also, you know, some behavioral health pieces that you may need, but also strong instruction. We need to make sure that we're addressing the instructional model in schools while providing the resources and support that children need to be more successful.
Kenney has also tapped Parks and Recreation Commissioner Mark DeBerardinas to be his managing director. DeBerardinas ran the State Department of Conservation and Natural Resources under former Governor Ed Rendell. Before that, he was a well-known community activist. As managing director, DeBerardinas will oversee day-to-day operations in City Hall. He pledges to maintain strong relationships with residents.
My experience tells me if we don't connect to citizens in what we do, we're not doing our jobs right. If we don't connect to citizens in what we do every day in government, we will not serve them as well, and we will not reach our policy objectives.
Kenney also named his campaign manager, Jane Slusser, as his chief of staff, and longtime aide Debbie Mahler will serve as liaison to City Council and Harrisburg. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
Now, a little less than a year out from the presidential election, let's talk politics. Joining me is Dick Pohlman, writer-in-residence at the University of Pennsylvania, national political columnist. He pens the National Interest blog at newsworks.org. Dick, welcome back to WHYY.
Thank you, Dave.
The next Democratic debate is in Des Moines. Saturday? How did they pick a Saturday?
Yeah, well, they picked a Saturday because everyone suspects, and it's never really been conclusively denied, that they're trying to limit Hillary Clinton's exposure to the public, you know, to sort of minimize if there are any gaffes or any bad moments. They've limited the number of debates, and they've picked a Saturday night because that is, according to statistics, arguably the lowest watched evening of TV.
One of the things that's come out is Hillary is so practiced at debating, and by contrast, Bernie Sanders was found somewhat lacking.
Well, I think one of the things that he has to do, just in terms of the telegenics here, is he has to do something he didn't do in the first debate, which is to just dial it down a bit. I mean, he was basically at the podium sounding like he was talking still to a crowd of 15,000 people in an arena, which Larry David parodied.
Larry David
so well
captured his curmudgeonly essence on Saturday Night Live, exactly.
I think he's got to tone it down and sort of maybe feel like, make it appear that he's engaging much more conversationally with the other people on stage. I've looked at some polls that have said that she has actually boosted her support within the Democratic electorate since that first debate, whereas he hasn't changed that much. There's a new CBS News poll right now that shows her ahead among likely Democratic voters by 19 points. And, you know, a lot of people on the Bernie Sanders camp were arguing, you know, that, he's closer than that, or he should be closer, or we should perceive him as being closer. But I think what she did was, during that first debate, was to reinforce the views of people in the Democratic base who were predisposed toward her but were a little bit uneasy. I think she sort of calmed them down and said that, she's in this for the long haul and she can weather whatever is thrown at her.
Bernie Sanders hails from a hunting state, and he's had to do this delicate dance regarding gun rights.
Well, yeah, gun rights. And so, you know, I don't know. We'll see if that comes up on Saturday night. And, you know, and he's in that tricky position, you know, the Democratic base is, including many Bernie Sanders supporters, I'm sure. You know, they want gun reform. They're very strong on gun reform. They're very anti-NRA. Whereas, as Bernie Sanders pointed out, you know, he's from a state where there's a lot of hunting, a lot of guns, as you just said. And he won his first congressional race way back in the early 90s with help from the state chapter of the NRA. I mean, ancient history, albeit. But when it came up in the questioning, they asked Hillary Clinton, do you think, you know, Bernie Sanders' position on guns is acceptable? And she said, absolutely not. And she came out with a very outspoken anti-NRA position.
So regardless of what Bernie Sanders can accomplish in his remaining time, Do you agree with those who contend it would take a real implosion on the Hillary Clinton campaign part to make it even competitive?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I mean, I think, you know, we've had their history and build to. We forget, you know, now he's like this, you know, renowned popular guy, won two terms and everything. But, you know, the ups and downs that he had, and they get into, you know, they get into these crazy, you know, hot water situations, and they always seem to find their way out of them again. And so, you know, I wouldn't necessarily want to sit here and predict at all that, you know, that there isn't going to be some more speed bumps on the emails. Although there was apparently some Justice Department or FBI report just the other day saying that there wasn't any seriously classified stuff. They haven't found anything like that. You know, my guess is still that the people who are most up in arms about her emails are the people who wouldn't vote for her anyway. But, you know, she runs – we saw this in 08 after she got behind Obama – and was trying to catch up in the spring. She runs best sometimes when she's
coming
like
from
the
behind.
Underdog, or when she's in a position of, you know, disadvantage. So, you know, it's such a long race, and she has to sustain this front runner thing, and, you know, and the press gets nudgy. It's like, all right, so this is the person who's ahead. So when is she going to make news? And news is conflict. And so, you know, there's kind of a built-in dynamic there that, you know, there's no story. So, as it were, if you're in front every single day. So we'll see. We'll see what comes down. If Bernie Sanders doesn't have a terrific showing in New Hampshire, which should be his kind of voters, then I think she's got fairly clear sailing, yeah.
Dick, we always bring you here because you do know what you're talking about. Thanks for coming into WHYY
My
Studios.
My pleasure, Dave. Thanks.
Dick Pohlman, writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania, and he pens the National Interest blog at newsworks.org. In Wilmington, Delaware, new townhomes will be built on Bennett Street, a high-crime area on the city's east side. The hope is that helping residents buy their own homes will curb violence. WHYY's Shirley Min reports on the initiative called East Side Rising.
Carrie Davis cuts through steel beams that are being used to build affordable housing for seniors on Wilmington's east side. This neighborhood is where Davis spent his early years.
Growing up as a kid, it was fun. It was, everything was love. But as you get older and these kids coming up nowadays, it's a total different change.
Now, crime and poverty are the norm on the east side. It caught up with Davis, who served time for selling drugs.
I came home, you know, from jail in 2008, and that was my cutoff point.
It's also the starting point of his new life in construction. Davis graduated from the Eastside Rising Training Center. It's a free jobs program run out of Central Baptist Church, located in the heart of the neighborhood. Gina Worthy runs it.
This is about building out a career and a life that you want, not just getting a job, because we want them to understand the difference between a job and a career.
The center partners with construction union Local 55. Members taught Davis the fundamentals, and the center taught him to write a resume and how to present himself during an interview and on the job.
You willing to learn and you hungry, they're going to teach you everything you need to know.
Reverend Terrence Keeling of Central Baptist established the training center a year and a half ago to complement the housing side of his East Side Rising initiative.
Owning a home is the end result of a process that brings less crime. Getting the job brings less crime. Getting the jobs put you in a position to own a home.
Davis's next job is to build the new Bennett Street townhouses, which will be done sometime next year.
The houses that we work on, they got a program where we be the first to rent to own these houses. And, you know, I'm definitely trying to get into that.
Davis says he loves making an honest living. And Gina Worthy says people are noticing.
His folks that he knew in his street days are coming to him like, Harry, what's happened different for you? They see a difference in him, and they realize that that's the type of difference that I think I want for my life.
And the type of difference Reverend Keeling hopes spreads throughout Wilmington. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Shirley Min, WHYY News.
Following New York and Boston's lead, Philadelphia is trying to determine if it could cut citywide greenhouse gas emissions 80% by the year 2050. A recent study says it's possible, and commercial buildings are key, as WHYY's Carolyn Beeler reports.
I met the report's author, Patrick Gurian, at 22nd and Market Streets, where skyscrapers and commercial buildings tower above us. He says these buildings are a big part of a greener future.
Why do buildings matter? Because they do account for 60% of the city's greenhouse gas emissions, because we have a dense land use, we're actually very efficient on transportation. And that leaves buildings as the big emitter for the city.
Gurian is an engineering professor at Drexel University. His report found retrofitting hospitals, schools, grocery stores, and retail establishments could be a net cost savings.
You take someplace that is very high energy use intensity, a supermarket with lots of refrigeration equipment, and you upgrade that and you can save a lot of energy, possibly even enough on the utility bills to pay for itself.
Overall, reducing carbon emissions by 80% would mean a combination of many people switching to walking or biking to work, retrofitting buildings, and increasing renewable energy production. Gurian's research team partnered with the Mayor's Office of Sustainability on the report, said the office's director, Catherine Gajewski.
So our greenhouse gas goals expire in 2015, and we're starting to consider what achievable but aggressive greenhouse gas reduction goals might be for Philadelphia, looking out midterm and long term.
Under its GreenWorks plan, the city has reduced municipal emissions 15% since 2009, but citywide emissions have gone down only 1% as extreme temperatures have driven higher energy use. I'm Carolyn Beeler, WHYY News.
Turning to this evening's headlines, five tank cars carrying crude oil derailed this morning at a rail yard in King of Prussia, Montgomery County. No oil spilled. No one was injured during the accident that occurred while crews were working to break up an 85-car train into smaller segments. The train was carrying a mix of crude oil and other freight. The derailed tank cars contain heavy crude, a tar-like substance that likely traveled from Western Canada. Philadelphia Mayor-elect Jim Kenney is in no rush to have Philadelphia police resume cooperating with federal immigration officials. Current Mayor Michael Nutter's administration is talking about working with Immigration and Customs Enforcement when it comes to those suspected of murder, rape, terrorism, or other serious crimes. Mayor-elect Kenney says he does not want to change the current policy.
It's a cultural thing for me as an Irish American that when the history of us in this country was in the 1840s, we were starved out of our own country and came here. We didn't have documents. We crawled off coffin ships and got to the docks of Boston, New York, and Philadelphia and other cities, and they didn't want us here either. People didn't want us here. They told us to go home, go back where we came from.
Kenney says he thinks the current policy encourages immigrants who entered the U.S. illegally to feel safe calling the police or testifying if they witness a crime. Advocates for immigrants are trying to keep the current policy in place until Kenney takes office in January. 51 degrees, mostly clear skies at 619. You're listening to NewsWorks tonight on WHYY. Tonight's low, 38 degrees. Sunny tomorrow, high around 50. It will feel colder, though, with wind gusts to 30 miles an hour. Sunday, sunny, warmer, high near 60. Sunshine for Monday, high 63. And ahead to Tuesday, a mix of sun and clouds, high in the low 60s. Still ahead. A zombie film by a young filmmaker upends stereotypes of Muslim Americans.
I want to show people that Muslims can be normal, too. They can still do stuff the same way.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
New Jersey's Clean Energy Program proudly supports WHYY. New Jersey's Clean Energy Program, incentivizing businesses, local governments, schools, and residents to integrate energy-efficient and renewable technologies into their new construction projects, existing building upgrades, and new equipment installation. More information about modernizing in your home and business with support from New Jersey's Clean Energy Program at njcleanenergy.com/WHYY.
The 39th Annual Philadelphia Museum of Art Contemporary Craft Show supports WHYY and brings 195 selected artists to the Pennsylvania Convention Center, November 12th through the 15th. Some of the nation's best fine craft artists display their work, from custom jewelry to one-of-a-kind furniture to hand-woven textiles and more. The artists will be on site to tell their stories, and artist demonstrations illuminate the techniques and inspiration of these masters of their craft. Information and tickets are online at pmacraftshow.org.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The fourth Republican presidential candidate debate is in the books. Let's look at lessons learned this week in Milwaukee with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Well, I presume it's too soon to have polling post-Tuesday, but let's rank the candidates in terms of favorability ratings at this juncture.
Yeah, we tracked that every night, and Ben Carson going into the debate clearly had the most favorable image, and I'm talking about a net favorable image where we look at the number of Republicans who like Ben Carson and subtract out the percent who have an unfavorable opinion. He has very low unfavorables, which means he nets out very positively. Right below Ben Carson are Ted Cruz, Texas Senator, and Marco Rubio, Florida Senator. They come in below Carson, significantly below Carson, and then everybody else is below that. Two interesting individuals with high name ID are Donald Trump, and he actually nets out very low because a lot of Republicans don't like him. He has pretty good favorables, but he also has the highest unfavorables of any candidate among Republicans, so he nets out fairly low. And Jeb Bush has high unfavorables as well and just doesn't have a lot of favorables among Republicans, so he nets out quite low as well. So that's the problem for Bush and Trump. They're well known, naturally, with the names Bush and Trump, but a lot of Republicans have unfavorable opinions of them.
I'm wondering, as we get closer, though, to primary season, to what extent does favorability give way to notions of electability, you know, perceived as worthy of occupying the White House, including serving as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces?
Very good question. And of course, the ultimate test of who gets the Republican nomination will be who votes for whom. And actually, that's a fairly small number of individuals. You know, the people who turn out to vote in Iowa, the relatively small number who'll turn out to vote in New Hampshire, then the smaller number who'll turn out in South Carolina, those things will start cascading. And of course, that will end up determining who's the nominee. But at this juncture, the image of the candidates, we think is very important to look at, because that tells us how the average Jane and John Doe Republican out there are viewing them as they go through this arduous process of debating and the media scrutiny and everything they've been going through this year.
All the candidates seem to take aim at dysfunction in government in Washington. And if you're Donald Trump or Carly Fiorina or Ben Carson, well, as an outsider, that's not as difficult as, say, for Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz.
Well, 11% of Americans now say they approve of the job Congress is doing. That's 2 points, only 2 points higher than our all-time low Congress approval, which was 9% during the fall of 2013 during the government shutdown. So that's certainly an easy target. Rubio, by the way, although he's a sitting senator, criticizes his own place of employment. He says, I'm not running again because Congress doesn't work. I need to be president so I can fix it, and so on and so forth. But clearly, all of our indicators tell us that Americans are very down on their elected representatives in Washington.
Put that 11% congressional approval rating in some historical context. When was the last time it was, say, around 50%?
Well, it's historically been low, and that's an important point. I'm glad you asked the question, Dave, because Americans have never in our polling history been all that positive about Congress. Congress approval generally runs quite a bit lower than, say, presidential job approval. So there's always been kind of a tension, a love-hate relationship between Americans and their elected representatives. But to find a time when a clear majority of Americans favored Congress, you have to go all the way back to right after 9/11, when Americans were very positive and certainly more positive about how Congress was doing its job. And Americans were more positive in the late 1990s during the dot-com boom. But clearly in recent years, consistently, although not as low as it is now, we've had, you know, 20%, maybe 30% who approve of Congress. It's never been all that high.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Projects from this summer's Muslim Youth Voices Project, a filmmaking workshop for Muslim teenagers, hits the big screen this weekend at the Philadelphia Asian American Film Festival. WHYY's Nima Roshania has more.
Musa Saeed says growing up in the early 90s with a budding interest in cinema wasn't always easy. As a Muslim, he was expected to address weighty topics tied to his faith, with little freedom to pursue the topics he had a real passion for. He's looking to change that for the next generation of Muslim filmmakers.
Maybe you feel like they have to talk about certain things or are made to respond to certain things that are going on in the world, but they also don't really often get a chance just to talk about things that they want to talk about.
This summer, Saeed held a week-long filmmaking workshop for Muslim youth in Philadelphia. The students completed short works that will premiere this weekend at the Philadelphia Asian American Film Festival. The shorts touch on universal topics, bullying, the importance of teamwork, and healthy eating, all the while weaving in fantasy, time travel, and of course, zombies.
Is Anna? Wait. Anna.
Ha ha ha! I've done it! My mind control brownies finally work!
That's a scene from 14-year-old Risky Chandra short, Food for Thought. In it, mind-controlling brownies distributed by an aspiring class president turn kids into zombies. Ultimately, it's carrots that save the day. Having the space for this kind of creativity is exactly what Saeed wants for his students.
For me, it was important for the sort of next generation of youth to be able to feel like they can have ownership of their stories.
After making Food for Thought, Chandra says the chance to flex his film skills alongside Muslim peers was invaluable.
It's important that I have known that there's people else around me who are the same and who are Muslim just like me. Doing this, it made me feel a little better knowing that, hey, I'm in this group and I should be proud of who I am.
11-year-old Galant Abedin's film focuses on a bully who finds great friendship.
I hope they walk away with a laugh and an idea in their head to spread the word of stop bullying. I want to show people that Muslims can be normal too. They can still do stuff the same way.
The shorts will premiere on Saturday from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the International House in University City. The Philadelphia Asian American Film Festival runs through November 22nd. For WHYY, I'm Nima Roshanya.
Finally, today brings Philadelphians the first chance to embrace the season as Dilworth Park's Rothman Ice Rink reopened at noon today. Still to come, in January, the rink will offer sled skating. Using specially designed sleds, Rothman will enable the physically and mentally disabled to take part in the fun in a way that wasn't possible before.
Skating away, skating away.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week from Brett Rader and our intern Kevin Rowley. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Diana Martinez and Adam Staniszewski. John Mussoni is acting vice president of news and civic dialogue. Find us on iTunes or listen at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
And as you cross the wilderness, suspending in your emptiness, you really have to pray.
Cabrini College is proud to support WHYY, now offering part-time doctoral degrees in organizational development and educational leadership. Cabrini can help you earn a PhD or EdD in 3 years without giving up your life. Their faculty and small classes help to expand your knowledge and professional network while giving you the tools to advance your career. More information on Cabrini's professional doctoral programs is available at cabrini.edu/doc.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, music that speaks the voice of America. The Philadelphia Orchestra and Yannick Nézet-Séguin perform Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring, plus the world premiere of Hannibal's One Land, One River, One People, with choruses from around the community. Tickets at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, an American celebration with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
The University of the Arts supports WHYY and is hosting a graduate open house Saturday, November 21st. It's an opportunity to learn about UArts master's programs in studio art, museum studies, art and music education, design for social impact, product design, jazz studies, theater, educational program design, and educational technology. UArts Graduate Open House, Saturday, November 21st, 2 to 5 p.m., 211 South Broad Street. Details at uarts.edu.